So I got to remember to breathe and swallow every once in a while so I don't get too nervous. When I was a kid, for some reason, teachers used to pick on me to get up in front of the school and the class to lead things and share things. And I'm a very, very quick talker. And I would get on this roll, and I would be talking so fast that I'd run out of saliva mid-sentence and kind of choke in front of 300 kids. Oh, it was so embarrassing. So I've got my water here, so hopefully I don't choke mid-sentence. But if I do, I know you'll forgive me. I am definitely an alcoholic, and I'm glad that I know that today. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and an alcoholic is the last thing I thought that I would become. Because I had a good plan, you see. I wasn't going to drink. And had I stuck to it, it would have worked. But, you know, every once in a while you get this really strong intuitive feeling, and sometimes we disregard those. And I listened to that voice for a number of years, and then I said, yeah, I'm going to give this thing a try, and maybe my outcome will be different than my father's was, not just like his. My chemical dependence actually started before I drank. My drinking started at 16. But I started taking prescription drugs, and I was very smug about addiction. I was never going to be a drug addict either. But I had acne, you see, and I had this doctor who I think now was quite a jackass. But he prescribed, I was 11, and he prescribed phenobarbital for acne. In addition to the standard tetracycline and sun lamp. And I said, you know, I'm falling asleep, because it's a sleeping pill, right? But it was like a quarter of a sleeping pill. And I told him, I'm falling asleep at school. I really don't like this. So he said, okay, we'll try something else. And he gave me Valium. And I said, oh, right. Now this I can live with. And it was a love affair. You know, I found out later it was basically alcohol in pill form. Same thing, central nervous system depressant, and it relaxed me. And he told me, your grades will go from A's to B's or B's to C's, but you seem to be kind of a driven type A person, and, you know, this will help you relax. So it didn't cure the acne, but I didn't give a crap. I did not give a crap anymore, so maybe it helped in that regard, you know. And then I think that children who grow up in alcoholic homes have different roles they play, so I've learned, and I was the family hero. I was going to do everything right, and maybe Dad would have one less reason to drink, and my non-drinking mother would have one less thing to be depressed about. So I did the chores, and I was a good girl in school, and I was very interested in getting attention and pleasing people. Very sick character trait, and it has haunted me in my life. You know, it's something I still have to work on. But anyway, that's who I was. Kind of almost nauseatingly good, you know. I in high school, I was in the Future Teachers of America. I was, you know, in the Honor Society. I played the clarinet. I was a real geek. And I got a job, and I would go to work, you know, from 4 to 9, several nights a week and weekends. And I worked with a bunch of teenagers, and one old lady who was 58, I'm 60 now, and it doesn't feel old, but at 16, I thought 58 was pretty old, and they would go out for pizza and beer after work. And this was in New York State, and the drinking age was 18. And in New York State, when I was 16, they did not have photographs on licenses. So you could very easily be 18 for the night. You know, you get somebody's driver's license who was your height, weight, and eye color, and you could drink. And then, you know, the discos were popular, and we started going to those, and I got my driver's license at 16, so there I was, drinking and driving. And, you know, sometimes I was 5'10 with brown eyes, and some of these people, check and proof, didn't really care. They wanted more females. Come on in, you know. And it was pretty loose, I think looser than it is today maybe. You know, now they card people in stores and, you know, they have undercover agents coming in to make sure people are abiding by those rules. But I'm sure youngsters have clever ways of taking care of their needs. But anyway, it wasn't that hard. It was not that hard. And I'll tell you, from the first time I drank, I was not different from my father. You know, actually, I'm just remembering, it wasn't 16. I had one episode at age 13. When I sampled alcohol, and it was a church conference. So if you're sending your kids to a little church retreat, might not be as pure as you think. And I met this cute little boy who had a bottle of peppermint schnapps in his backpack. And we snuck into his room, and he gave me a couple swigs, and we kissed a few times, and I thought, this is pretty exciting, you know. tasted good, felt good, and I would, oh boy, you know, and that was it. That was it. But I do remember it being a very pleasurable, positive thing. And then I kind of went back to my smug, I will never drink again, and be like my dad. And then 16 rolled around, and I was with these kids that, you know, worked hard, and then they would go out for pizza and beer, and they wouldn't invite me because I didn't drink. And I thought, you know, I really want to be a part of this group, and maybe I can just do it differently. So off I went. And one of my first drinking experiences, there was an 18-year-old. She was graduating from high school and going off to college. And, oh, water break, wait a minute. Getting dry there. And she bought in a bottle of Black Velvet whiskey to work. And we were going to party after work. The store closed at 10. And she said, well, it's kind of quiet. Let's start early. So, sounds good to me. So my friend, she's still my best friend, not an alcoholic, but she poured me a drink. It was about this much Black Velvet and this much 7-Up. And I tipped my head back and just belted that sucker down the way I saw my father do. You don't sip, you just drink, you know. And a couple like that, and I was making a milkshake for a customer, and it fell off the machine, and I was getting sprayed with milkshake, and I was cackling like this was the funniest thing in the world. And so they said, we are going to get fired. You know, so on that 20 questions, you ever drink on the job? Yeah, real early on I did. So they locked me in the bathroom, and somebody else came and said, give me your uniform, get into your going out clothes, because I got to finish your shift for you. And so somebody rescued me from the consequences, you know, potential consequences of that drinking. But, you know, in those days, you would laugh about those things, and your friends would make you feel good about it. You know, well, you were funny. Oh, my gosh. You know, even though I puked just about every time, it was worth it because they kept reminding me about that good time that I had. You know, I was a blackout drinker very early on, and sometimes I was relieved probably about the things that I didn't remember, you know. One of three things were guaranteed to happen when I drank. I would puke, have a cry and jag, or start kissing a stranger. You know, the one or some nights all three, in any order. Like, you know, could my dad died when I was a senior in high school, and I remember I had this sociology teacher I kind of had a crush on, and we gave him a bottle of what's that Japanese sake? What's it called? Yeah, sake. We gave him a bottle of sake, and he invited us to drink with him. I mean, yeah, the guy was kind of loose, but anyway, he knew something I didn't know, that I was going to receive some scholarships at this assembly the next day, and he said, make sure you're sober. Don't drink. You know, and I don't think he knew how much I did drink. He probably thought, you know, just typical teenager sampling it now and again. I told you I played the clarinet, so I had a really good excuse. I was kind of like this twofold person. You know, the teachers thought I was one person, and now my peers were beginning to see me in another light. So I would say, I'm going to my clarinet lesson, and I'd go smoke a joint behind the school or get my little thermos out that I thought I had so coolly smuggled some booze into. And I didn't think this was disease behavior. I just thought, it's fun. You know, this is just fun. I'm just having a good time. Well, I got three scholarships, and my father died in April of my senior year, and my mother said, don't change a thing. You go off to college like you planned. And, you know, I had been drinking now for a couple of years, and I think in a way she was like, I don't know what to do with her. You know, she went from being this really good kid, and now she's doing this. And, you know, first a drunken husband, now a drunken daughter. Go to school. You know, do your thing. Because she had never really had to discipline me, and I don't think she knew how. She just didn't. I always stopped myself. And so this was different for her. So I went off to college, and when my father died, I believe that I cried every day for part of the day over his death. And part of the grief was not just about him dying, but it was about the life that we had together. You know, that he hadn't been the kind of dad that I had dreamed for and hoped for. And I was very bitter, and I was very angry about his drunkenness. My father wasn't mean-spirited to me, usually. I don't think I was ever spanked in my lifetime. There was no sexual abuse. But, you know, verbally, he would change, and he would call up people, like local politicians, and cuss them out and tell them off. And I would be like, oh, it's so embarrassing. And then he'd come when there was a concert, and I'm playing the clarinet, and he'd be the fool. he had to clap three more claps than everybody else. And I thought, everybody knows my stupid father is out there drunk clapping. And, you know, I would just be, why didn't he stay home? You know, and my friends would come, and sometimes he'd be jovial. One time he took the roof off our house, part of it, because the roof leaked. Every year he'd get up there with the tar paper, and it would leak again. So we'd have the buckets. And it was an old Victorian house. So he decided it's the slope of the roof. I'm going to reconstruct the whatever. He thought he was an architect. A little grandiose, could do anything. So he took the roof off, and it started to rain, and everything is in boxes in the rest of the house. There's, you know, skylight, because he got drunk and the project got delayed. And my mother's in the living room crying, and my friends are going, your dad is so cool, man. And we're playing old maid, eating cookies and laughing, and I'm thinking, you think he's cool. I think this is kind of mortifying, actually, you know, but... So that was my life, and I went off to college, and I was pretty sad, and people would say, you know, you cried enough, come on, let's go to the Rathskeller, the bar that was crawling distance from my dorm, so let's go there and have a good time. And, you know, it was easy to be a drunk in college because a lot of people drank like I did. I didn't particularly stand out, at least the ones in the bar. You know, I mean, young people drink to get drunk pretty much. They're not sippers, you know, they're not really social drinkers too much. So there I was, and there was a lot of marijuana smoking in those days. And I was fat. The last thing I needed was something to increase my appetite. So here I'm fat, and I've got acne, but I got my Valium and my joints and my alcohol, so who gives a crap, you know? And one day I remember this cleaning lady came in, and we decided to skip some classes, and we were eating our fourth piece of pumpkin pie because we just smoked a joint. And she said, oh, you girls are so joyful. And I started crying. We're not joyful. She thinks we're joyful. We're really not. And, you know, this is pitiful who we are. And but it's the truth. It was pretty pitiful, you know. There was a lot of laughter, but there, you know, I was really majorly depressed. And I was very clinically depressed even before. You know, but I could clown. I had a good sense of humor, so I could fool people sometimes, you know, and manage to get pretty good grades. I only blew one class because of procrastination and two. Political science. I tried to read the textbook the night before the exam, and it didn't work out too well. You know, drinking a lot of coffee, and it didn't work out very well. But I managed to get a C-, I think. And then statistics. Oh, no, that was my only D. That was really bad. But one thing I did in sobriety, I retook that class just to prove I wasn't stupid to myself, you know, and I got an A. So I was like, all right, you're not dumb after all. It was the booze that brought you down that time. But when I went away to college, I was sexually inexperienced, and it was one of those things I was hoping to be relieved of fairly quickly. And they had this keg, $3 and all the beer you can drink. I said, what a great savings. Is anybody going with me? No, we don't want to go. It was in the afternoon. It was light out, you know, but this bar had no windows, pitch black in there. I went on the bus. It was a smart thing that they let us go on the bus rather than drinking and driving. And I picked up this guy, or he picked me up. I don't know which way it went. And I invited him to my room. But then I puked and fell, and he left. And so nothing happened. And I was like, oh, man. Missed the opportunity. And my roommates, it started raining, and they said, we want to go walking in the rain, but what do we do with her? So they tied me to a chair because they just were, you know, first I'm locked in the bathroom at work, now I'm tied to a chair. So I feel sorry for my roommate, you know. I showed up with a case of Boone's Farm apple wine, and, you know, she probably thought, oh, man, what is this? But anyway, I spent three semesters there, and then I took a geographic cure. I said, I haven't met him. He's not here. I'm going back to Buffalo, and maybe he'll be there. And I went to the University of Buffalo and moved in with some roommates and, you know, stayed with my mom briefly, and she very quickly encouraged me to get my own place. And I wonder why. And I did. And the first sociopath I met, I fell in love with. He was very handsome, 6'5", tall, dark, and handsome, and I was just, like, in love. But, you know, that people-pleasing came out, and this guy really didn't have very good morals, and I was so eager to please that I ended up just, I'm not going to go into the details, but I did some things that I'm not proud of to get this guy's attention and hold it, and it went on for quite a while. And I just couldn't seem to... I would date others, but I always just pined away for this guy, and he would date others, and then I'd call him or he'd call me, and we'd get back together, and it was pretty sick. But the best thing that happened while I was at the University of Buffalo was that I decided to take a class on alcoholism. And I say I decided. I think God decided I was going to take a class on alcoholism. And I had become an agnostic. I went to church as a kid, and I was a believer, but I prayed a lot for my dad's sobriety. I prayed for a sober family over and over and over. And when he died at the age of 51 drunk, I was really angry. I really thought, I think God created us, but I think those prayers are a waste of time. It didn't happen, and I don't think he's really up there pulling strings for us. We have to figure these things out on our own. And so I was mad. But anyway, I think now that God directed me to sign up for that class. Why would an alcoholic take a class on alcoholism, you know? But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. So I really thought, I'm going to study the disease that I think helped kill my father. He was a smoker, a drinker, and he was overweight, and there was a heart history in his family, so it was a multiple of things. But one of the things I learned in my first job in sobriety as an alcoholism counselor was that the main medical killer of alcoholics is actually heart disease. So a lot of people think of cirrhosis, but it's not the main thing. The main thing is heart, and the muscles around the heart get weak, or there's a lot of extra fat in the blood that predisposes people to heart trouble. So anyway, little fact there for you. But I took this class, and I started hearing things that fit me. And one of the things that really dramatically helped me, and if you've never seen it, and if you're struggling trying to figure out if you are or if you aren't an alcoholic, you might want to take a look at this Jelnik chart. Get a copy. And if you don't have one, you can talk to me afterward. I'll mail you one. How many people are here? I might be sending a lot of letters out. But anyway, it's like a curve. And it talks about the signs and symptoms, and then it divides early, middle, late. And so it says, in the early stages, unable to stop after one or two drinks. Well, that was absolutely me. You know, didn't I try it? You know, yeah, when I almost died of alcohol poisoning and fell down the stairs and broke the heel off my shoe, and I tried. You know, those things happened when I was 19 and I was throwing a party for my brother. And I had to be carried to bed by 8:30. And the rest of the group was going out because in Buffalo, bars were open till 4. So we started late. You know, we'd go out 9 or 10 dancing. And so the party was early, and then we were going to go out. But they had to carry me to bed. And apparently, I started vomiting in my sleep, which could have killed me. But my mother heard this, my poor mother, and she dragged me to the bathroom and saved my life, basically. And the next day, I remember two questions. Why did you drink like that? I don't know, Mom. How many did you have? I have no idea. I don't remember. You know, so what I know now is that was because I was powerless over alcohol. I had that X factor, that predisposition toward this disease that when I ingest alcohol, it's nothing to do with willpower, nothing to do with mind over matter. It has everything to do with physiology. And I couldn't stop. And I learned later that out of 10 drinkers, one is like me. You know, one out of every 10 ends up alcoholic because we can't do it any other way. I did not want to be an alcoholic, but I couldn't do it any other way. So I took that class. I learned about blackouts. I thought that maybe it had to do with a certain beverage. If I changed to a different one, they'd stop. If I ate first, if I waited to be in a good mood, none of that worked. They kept happening. They started lasting longer, happening more frequently, and they were embarrassing. You know, sometimes people would tell me things I did or said, and I'd think, oh, my God, what a moron. How could I have acted like that, you know? So that stood out for me, and you know, a few more classes, and I thought, wow, I think that I have this problem. So I stopped drinking. I flushed the Valium down the toilet, and I'm really lucky I didn't have a seizure, I learned later, you know. I had a lot of sleepless nights. I was restless, irritable, tossing and turning, crying, weeping, depressed. My mother said, "What's wrong to you?" And I made a couple of confessions about some of the trouble that I'd gotten into. And she said, "Well, I wish you would have told me you were going through that. I could have helped you, you know." And I didn't drink, and I thought, problem solved. And I graduated early from college. I graduated in 3 years, double major, psychology and sociology. Every twisted person wants to major in psychology, and that's why I did. I remember going into this abnormal psychology class, and I popped a Valium on the way in, and I had a brief moment of clarity that told me, there's something not right about this. I don't think the majority of your classmates are popping Valium on the way into abnormal psychology, but again, it was just one of those fleeting notions, and I tried to go to a counselor at the University of Buffalo, and I told them it was one of those really bad days, and I said, you know, I need to talk to somebody. And they said, what is the nature of your problem? And I said, I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't know yet that it was alcoholism, but I knew I was very depressed. I wanted to die. You know, I just wanted to end my life. And she said, well, there's nobody available, but give me your name and number, and they'll call you later. So later, somebody called, and I said, problem, no. And by then, I'd had a Valium, a joint, and a drink, and I felt good. I said, no, there is no problem. I don't know. I was a little down earlier today, but I'm okay now. And went back into my denial mode, you know. But anyway, I did manage to stop drinking, and it's quite miraculous, you know, quite miraculous. And I was so bold that I got a job in the alcoholism field, and I had no program. I just did not drink. And I had a degree in psychology and sociology. And I got this job about, I don't know, maybe 10 months after I graduated at the Niagara County Council on Alcoholism in Niagara Falls, New York. And there I learned a wealth of information. That Jelinek chart was one of the things I saw. And I saw, wow, okay, you're here. Now, if you keep going, you're going to experience the job loss, the divorces. Of course, I wasn't married and I didn't own a home to lose. I didn't, you know, I'd never lost a job. But I saw all these things that could happen, and I believed it. And I saw also that you could end up dead. You could end up institutionalized. And I realized that, my God, I could have died, even though in some ways I was in the early stages. I could have gone past the middle and the late and right to death because I was drinking and taking Valium simultaneously. That's not a good combination. I learned later that one drink and one pill does not equal two. That it multiplies the effect tremendously. It's called synergism, and I don't know why, but I don't know if it's the liver or what organ, but anyway, the effect becomes much more powerful, and you can end up in a coma or dead. I didn't. I told you I drank and I drove. I did that many times, and I never had a DUI. I was capable. I was guilty. Once I got stopped for speeding, and I really was drunk, but I didn't get a ticket for DUI. And many times I would give my friends the keys who were also drunk, but probably a couple not as drunk as me. And, you know, I could have been the drunken passenger who got hurt behind them driving drunk. My decisions were not sound. And, you know, that movie, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, I don't know if you ever saw that movie or remember, that's kind of how I was, kind of like volunteer by day, sleaze by night, you know. And I again, that clarinet player and then the pot smoker, it was like, who will the real Gene please stand up? And I was such a faker. But I, you know, who knows? Any of those clowns could have killed me, you know. I don't know who they were. Half the time I didn't know even people's last names or, you know, it was really sleazy. But it was the 70s, so what can you say? Part of the time, maybe. I'll blame it on that. So I got this job, and I kept learning and learning, and I did that for a year, and I didn't drink. I was still unhappy, though. You know, imagine that. I had this sort of disposition before I drank. I was a worrier, and I was depressed, and I was a people pleaser. And those things were all still there, and the self-doubt. Oh, the fat, the acne, that was still there. So I was still, you know, I'd go on these crazy diets and get thin for a minute, and then I'd go back to compulsive eating and gain the weight and hate myself for that. And that went on for many, many years. So anyway, I got another job, and it was one of those 28-day programs that I don't even know if they have them anymore, but that's what insurance paid for, so that's what they had. And I got to be a counselor trainee there. And my angel was there. Mary Louise was her name. Mary Louise C., and she said, you know, you might want to go to a program. I said, well, what, like what, AA? Really? I haven't had a drink in a year. She goes, yeah, really. I think it would help a lot. And so she took me to the Mod Squad. That was the name of this meeting in Tonawanda, New York. And that TV show, The Mod Squad, was going on at the time. And Link, and what was her name? I forgot. But anyway, Julie, yeah. And what was the other guy's name? Who's the trivia person here? I forgot. Anyway, I went to the Mod Squad meeting and you know, I thought, you know what, she's right. She is really right. And with the steps, got to work on those character defects that were driving me crazy. And I'll tell you, one of my hugest character defects was that blaming other people for my unhappiness. It always was somebody else's fault. Made the list, checked it twice, who's naughty and nice. And I'm telling you, I would complain to anybody about it in a heartbeat. that a lot of children don't talk about their parents drinking. I would talk to anybody who would listen. I swear, I was a whiner from the get-go. I did a fifth step before I knew what one was. I would tell somebody in a bar the whole sad story. This is who I resent, and this is what they did. And the only part was those last two columns were missing. You know, there was nothing about my part because I didn't play a part. The only was that it affected me, you know. But I got to look at that. What is your part? Oh, really? I had a part in that? You know, yeah. And that managed to carry on even into, you know, sobriety. I have been forced to look at my part and make amends and say I'm sorry for things. But anyway, the sobriety continued, and my sobriety date is February 28th, 1974, and I was 21 when I stopped drinking, and I celebrated 39 years in February, and I turned 60. That's, you know, I want to clap to you because you've given me this life and the ability, and the God I didn't believe in has given me this. You know, he guided me to that class. He guided me to Mary Louise, who guided me to AA. You know, my sponsor's Fairly, and I just got to give her a 49-year cake. And now there's a woman who is a hell of a role model. This woman knows how to stay sober no matter what. I mean, you've probably heard her story, and if not, she'll tell it. But she's been through some unbelievable things and didn't drink. No matter what, you know, and she's my sponsor, and I love her. She's an incredible woman. Some of the incredible things that have happened in sobriety, one was, you know, when I had 30 years sobriety, I got a ticket at the spring roundup, and I got to speak at the old-timers meeting. And it was when I was up at the podium that it dawned on me that that prayer was really answered. The prayer for the sober family happened. It didn't happen with my dad, but my children never saw their mom take a drink. So the prayer for the sober family was answered. You know, you never know. The time frame might not be the one you had in mind, but, you know, some of us benefit from our own experience and some from others and some from a combination and some don't seem to make it at all. But, you know, I guess I'm one of those that I benefit from hearing your stories. And, you know, I wonder why have I had 39 years and I've seen other people who can't get 39 days. You know, I have people who could shingle a house in 90-day tokens. They could open a serenity shop. And not that they don't love this program and they don't try. They do. They do. But it says here on page 24, and it's in italics. I was reading the italicized parts the other day just to see if there's a theme or a rhyme or reason to the italics. And it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. That's why I keep coming. One of the reasons that I keep coming to this program, because I want to stay reminded of that. You know, and I've heard many people talk about relapse, and nobody talks about it in a positive way. I'm still waiting to meet that person who said, hey, I'm still out there, and it's really working for me. Three women in Escondido I sponsored are dead because they tried it again, and it didn't work. And I could tell you their stories. They're heartbreaking, heartbreaking. But I want to talk about something more positive. Some of the wonderful things that have happened because of this transformation, and this is a program of transformation. You know, if you do these steps, you will change. You know, it has changed me for the better, and the longer I stay sober, the more awestruck I am by this program and how marvelous it is. You know, I mentioned the two sons. They're incredible young men. Long story short, I married a guy from another country. He kidnapped my son when we were involved in a divorce, and he took my son to Libya when he was 3 years old. And I got to go there. And this program taught me how and what to do. I wanted to collect enough money to send an assassin in his direction. Believe me, I was so filled with rage when it happened. Some of you knew me then, and you know that it was hard. But he said, it's a package deal. If you want your son, you get me too. And the day that I arrived in Libya was the day my divorce was to be final, and I told the lawyer, put it on hold. And I stayed there 3 years with him, had another child, stayed with him another 7 in this country, and I never put arsenic in his dinner. I never slept with a knife under my pillow to get him. And you know what? You told me, you have to read Freedom from Bondage in the big book, and you must do what it says. And it says you must pray for the one you despise. You must pray for the one you resent. You must pray for them to have the good things in their life you want in your own. It took more than 14 days, I'm going to tell you the truth, for me to get over this one. I mean, even after the marriage ended, I have been known to whine and complain about it and get pity from y'all. But today, we did finally have a peaceful divorce. The second time around, after 10 more years together, he said, "I know you don't love me. You're here for the kids." And I was going to tough it out till the youngest was 18. That was the plan. And he said, let's just have a peaceful adult divorce. You're a wonderful woman. I'll never do what I did last time. It was mean-spirited. It was horrible. You're a great mother. I want to be your friend forever." He's been married twice more to Libyan women. And I'm friends with his current wife. She's a lovely woman. She's been a great stepmother to my sons. And I can call him, and I can talk. We have one son who's bipolar, and he's had some really challenging times with hospitalizations and suicidal ideation and all that. And so we've had to collaborate and talk about him. And we can do that. And you know, one of the things this program taught me, too, is don't complain to your children about your ex-husband. Talk to your sponsor. Talk to another woman in the program or a man. Don't complain about him to them. So I did sometimes, but I stopped doing it. And as a result, you know, my children respect both their parents. And it's all because of this program. I have an incredible husband now, Bill, who is just the most fabulous example of AA that you would ever want to meet. Many of you have heard him speak, and he's amazing. Bill's had a lot of health challenges, and he had his leg amputated, and I'm going to say this, and I got 5 more minutes, but I got to tell you this story. Bill had his leg amputated. First, he had a toe amputated, and he got a spinal cord injury from a doctor's mistake and lost the ability to walk. And then he bumped his toe with his electric wheelchair getting in the car. We didn't realize it got infected, and the infection spread, and the doctor said, "We have to cut your leg off or you're going to die, because the infection will go in your bloodstream and your bones and kill you." So he said, "But you have to wait a week." And they said, "No, we can't wait. This has to happen now." So he said, "Well, on one condition, that I can get out by Sunday, because I have a very important speaking engagement." So they amputated his leg Thursday. And Sunday, he was on the stage at the Roots meeting. You know, he was 30 years sober, and he was invited to speak. And he said, "AA gave me my life." And he threw up before he left the hospital. They said, "Are you sure you're going?" He said, "I'm sure I'm going." And I was never so proud of anybody. You know, God has given us an incredible life. And we get to give a little bit back. Not as much as we've received, I'm sure. I was a probation officer for 10 years, and I worked in juvenile drug court. Again, God placed me in the perfect spot. I was a probation officer already when they created juvenile drug court. 3 years I'd been a PO, and nobody wanted to go. I said, "I will." And everybody looked at me like, "You friggin' insane." Most of them didn't know I was an alcoholic. I said, "No, I want to do that. I think it'll be a real challenge." And I got to work with kids who were just like I was, a teenage drunk. Many of them had alcoholic parents. I'd been a teacher for a few years, and I'd been a substance abuse counselor for most of my career. So it was like all these experiences in life, personal and professional and educational, came together. And I got to be of service in that way. And then I got to retire early and help take care of my husband, which is an honor, although sometimes he probably doesn't believe that I feel like that, because I can get whiny about that sometimes, especially when I have to wake up, you know, real early, and I'm one of those 8 or 9 hour sleep people. I've discovered I need that. But anyway, Bill's an incredible man, and I never saw him cry about his disability. I never saw him cry. He said, "Why? I'm alive. I have so many people who love and care about me." When we got married, we had, I don't know, 150 sober people. Even the drunks were sober, because we didn't serve alcohol. And they might have been tiptoeing out to the car, but it was a sober celebration, and it was so amazing. When we walked into that reception hall, everybody was screaming and yelling, and I spoke yesterday at Southeast Alano Club. I don't speak that often, but it just happened that I had two back-to-back. And I said, you know, in 1953, when I was born, it was unheard of, really, for blacks and whites to get married. And we got married in 2002, and here's this collection of people cheering and happy for us, you know. And and AA helps change people in lots of ways. People get over bigotry and prejudice, and or if they have it, they learn to stifle it a little, you know. So anyway, it's been an incredible life so far, and I know that everybody's life comes to an end, but I hope that when mine ends, it will be with sobriety. I have many wonderful people, women who I sponsor, who give me more than I get. My mother just died, and I just want to close with this. My mother was 86. She had congestive heart failure and lung disease, and I was going through her things as she was dying, sorting out, cleaning out, and I found this folder. Actually, this was after she died, and it was a few memorabilia. You know, it was a letter she got in 1945 from her college to her parents saying she was a good student and things like that. And in there was a letter that I wrote on my fourth anniversary of sobriety. And I was in California. I had just moved. And I said, I think it's about time I stop bitching and moaning about my life and blaming other people. See, it was still happening. And it's about time I start working on those character defects with sincerity and using this program that's at my feet to change me and transform me. And my mother saved that letter. And I also saved a birthday card that she sent me a couple years ago. And in it, she said, you know, you've had some unusual experiences in your life that many people haven't, some hard ones. And they've made you better for it. You're just such an incredible, compassionate, loving woman. And she would call me and she'd say, you and Bill are two of the most wonderful people in the world I've ever met. I got to hold her hand when she was you know, in her, you know, last couple of weeks of life and comfort her. And she kept saying, you're amazing. Thank you. Thank you. I said, Mom, quit thanking me. I'm 60 years old. You've mothered me for 60 years. It's my turn to thank you. And there's nothing that was left unsaid. You know, any kind of uneasiness I had toward my mother, the steps helped me work through, and I got to appreciate what a beautiful mother she was. And I got to also heal my memory of my father. If he could have done better, he would have done better. And he was much more than an alcoholic. I got to look at the whole picture. And he unintentionally hurt people, just like I unintentionally hurt people. So, you know, the program heals all kinds of things. It helps us not drink, but it helps us heal, and it helps us mature and grow up. And I just want to thank you. You're way cheaper than psychiatry, believe me. I spent a lot of money on that over the years. So $2 in the basket, of, you know, number of times a week, and what a bargain. Thank you for listening.